I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, and welcome to a new episode of Women Who Travel, a podcast from Condé Nast Traveler. Before we begin, we're asking for your feedback on our show. We'd love to know what stories you'd like to hear, what you've enjoyed the most and the least. So go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. This week's show is about two adventures along the Colorado River, the first in 1938 and the second in 2021.
I never imagined doing a trip like that, but I had to. I had to follow in the footsteps of these two women and find out what they experienced when they went on that journey in 1938.
Science journalist Melissa Sevigny lives in Flagstaff, Arizona, and grew up in Tucson, meaning the Grand Canyon was never too far away, but she'd only ever seen it like a tourist. So her decision to go down to the river level and run rapids in a two-person rubber boat was definitely not something she'd tried before.
I was going to have to run the Grand Canyon. That was not on my radar. It was never on my bucket list. Yeah, I certainly went into that trip with a fair amount of imposter syndrome. I'd never run a river before. I'm not a botanist. I felt very intimidated by the whole concept of being able to contribute to this scientific expedition I was on and be useful and not lose my head if something went wrong. Where I grew up in the desert, I would think of rivers as being dry riverbeds, you know, rivers of sand. And it never really occurred to me as a child that you could put a boat on a river and go on a boat trip. So this is the first time that I've done a river trip, this trip through the Grand Canyon of Arizona.
I have to admit, I have lived in the US for a little over a decade now, and I have still never been to the Grand Canyon, and I've never seen the Colorado River, which I actually think is the case for also many Americans who were born here. The country is so vast, and it just feels like it's almost mythologized now as this great natural thing that you can go see and experience, and you got to know it very well.
Most people see the Grand Canyon from the South Rim, Grand Canyon National Park South Rim. And if you see a photograph of the Grand Canyon, that's probably where the photo was taken, right? You see all of those banded colors and all of these layers. That's kind of the classic Grand Canyon view. And the incredible thing is if you're standing on the rim looking down, it's actually quite hard to see the river. You know, you hear about this powerful river that carved the Grand Canyon, but it's way, way down at the bottom, a mile down, and it looks like just this little silver thread.
Melissa's book, which came out earlier this year, is called Brave the Wild River, the untold story of two women who mapped the botany of the Grand Canyon. Melissa retraces an expedition where two women mapped the ecosystem of the Colorado River. She researched 1938 newspaper stories disparaging Elzada Clover and Louis Jotta. Reporters called them school moms, but they were academic botanists with a thirst for exploration.
I wanted to have the experience of actually working on a Grand Canyon trip, so I would have a better idea of what it was like for Elzada Clover and Lois Jotter, who were trying to collect plants while getting their boats down the river. So I joined up with a botany crew in 2021. We went down the river, and our job was to weed. Our job was to weed the Grand Canyon. Which sounds a little silly, but the Grand Canyon has non-native plants that don't belong there, that disrupt the ecology. And we were looking for one in particular called Ravenna grass. It sounds like it might be small and easy to weed, but it can actually grow to like the size of a Christmas tree and take a little bit of effort to find them and get them out. And so I was on a six-person crew. We had three boats, and we rode through the Grand Canyon for 2 weeks looking for this grass and weeding it out.
You're doing this volunteering, you're looking for this weed. How, as you're doing it all, are you also, for your book and for your research, channeling Lois and Elzada?
Yeah, I really did feel like I was channeling them. I had this little notebook in my pocket that it's a write in the rain notebook. It's supposed to.
Oh, I have that notebook. I use that. I used it for the Amazon.
It's nice. It's supposed to like kind of not wash away when it gets wet. I have to say it's write in the rain. It's not write in the rapid. And I got soaked going through the rapids and a lot of the words washed away. And because of that, every night I would stay up late with a flashlight and I'd copy it into a bigger notebook and just make a lot of notes. You know, I had marked down on my map of the Grand Canyon places where these two women, Elzeta and Lois, saw or experienced certain things. And when I got home, I actually kind of went through it and I typed up the bits that I thought I could use.
I'm going to get more to their story in a bit because it is truly fascinating. But I want to know a little bit more about your experience first. I mean, it's an extraordinary journey. I don't think many people get to do that. And also, I don't think I quite understood how big that this sounds really silly, but like how big the Grand Canyon is, not in the depth, but in the length of it.
Yeah, it's huge. It takes about 2 weeks on an oar trip. So a trip where they're rowing the boats with oars to get through the Grand Canyon. It just keeps going and going.
And you were using oars?
Well, not me personally, but my boatman, the person who was rowing my boat, was using the oars. Yes. Yeah, so they weren't very big boats. They're these kind of rubber rafts. And there would be two of us in a boat, one person rowing and me bailing. My job was to, one of the boats didn't bail itself. So I had to bail it. With a bucket anytime we went through a rapid.
I was going to say, what is bailing? Because in my head, it's sort of very much like a pirates at sea throwing water
out
of
the boat. Yes, that's exactly what it is. We would go through a rapid, the boat would fill up with water, and as we were still going through the rapid, I would get the bucket and I'd toss all that water out because it makes the boat very heavy and hard to maneuver.
Were you comfortable on the rapids? Did they feel scary?
I was terrified. I had never done anything like that before.
I'm kind of actually honestly relieved to hear you say that because you were speaking about it with such authority and confidence. I was like, oh God, I'm like such a weed because I would be terrified.
No, I was terrified. I think it was good that I was terrified because I'm sure Lois and Elzeta must have been terrified too. Like they were going down the river at a time when, you know, hardly anybody had done this trip and there weren't really good maps and there were these clunky wooden boats and they must have been terrified, and so I'm glad I felt that way, because I think I was able to channel what they felt on their trip.
How long did it take you to feel like you could take this constant sort of tirade against you of these rapids?
It took me about 3 days to unhinge my brain from all of my worries and my nervousness and to really be present in what I was experiencing. And, you know, the nervousness never exactly went away, particularly when we would hit a rapid that had a lot of stories around it. Some of the rapids in the Grand Canyon have their own mythology. A lot of terror stories about things that went wrong.
Was there a particular one that had been really sort of mythologized for you all that you were kind of building yourselves up to?
I mean, the big one is Lava Falls, and it comes very late in the trip. It's kind of one of the last big rapids that you reach in the Grand Canyon. And there's an expedition that's going just ahead of us, and one of their boats flips over in the rapid.
Oh my God.
A pretty bad thing to have happen. And everybody's fine. There are no injuries. You know, everyone does what they're supposed to do in an emergency and they get to safety. But watching that happen just ahead of me, I was like, I do not want to have that happen to my boat. I have very little confidence in my skills as a swimmer.
But you made it over.
Yeah, we roared right through that rapid and it was okay.
And you didn't flip the whole trip?
We didn't flip the whole trip. Thank goodness.
That would have just been the thing I was winding myself up about. I remember like when I was learning how to kayak, given it was in like freezing cold England, it wasn't very glamorous, but being taught what to do if you capsize and how to like push yourself out of the kayak. And it was one of the most claustrophobic things I've ever done. I hated it.
Oh, yeah.
So I can't imagine what it would be like to be on a rapid.
Yeah, there's a sense of if that river grabs me and wants to keep me, there's not much I can do about it. There were a few drowning deaths that had occurred. And there was one expedition that got caught in a landslide that came down the side of the cliffs and took them out, took out their camp, and someone died in that experience. And they were doing nothing wrong. They hadn't camped in a bad spot. I mean, running the river today is much, much safer. You know, But it didn't feel like that to me because I was really like mentally living in 1938. And so just in case, you know, I wrote a letter to my husband telling him a bunch of practical things about, you know, computer passwords and whatnot, but also telling him, you know, that I loved him just in case I didn't come back. And I put that in my safe before I went on the journey and told a friend that it was there.
Did you let him read it once you got back safely?
No, he didn't read it.
I would be like, part of me would be like, I want you to see how much I care.
No, he hasn't read it. I think it might still be in there.
After the break, reading the diaries and letters from Elzada Clover and Lois Jotta to find out how they camped, what they ate, and how they almost didn't make it.
Did you guys hear about that couple that went on vacation and one spouse murdered the other? In fact, the entire vacation was planned just so that they could make the murder look like an accident.
Ah, so like a slaycation.
Oh boy, sounds like a fun new true crime podcast to me.
On every episode of Slaycation, we'll examine true cases of people who were killed while on vacation.
Was it murder? Or just a horrible accident? That's up to you and the law to decide.
But either way, if you leave for your vacation in the plane and come home under the plane, you've definitely gone on a slaycation.
Join us every week for a fascinating new episode.
911, what's your emergency?
But make sure to pack your body bags,
because getting away can be murder.
This is Slaycation.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to level up? For me, it's my hiking boots, which have gotten me over some pretty tough terrain. And I'm not talking about my morning commute on the New York City subway. They've pushed me to go to far-off places like trekking in the remote mountains in Patagonia, wildlife spotting amid the thick rainforest of the Amazon, and climbing through canyons in the Utah desert. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. There's an available panorama glass roof, 33-inch all-terrain tires, and multi-terrain select driving modes. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior means that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Lois and Elzada, the subject of your book and the whole reason why you embarked upon this trip, tell me about them. Who were they?
So Elzada Clover and Lois Jotta were two botanists from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And in 1938, they cooked up this somewhat crazy plan to run the Grand Canyon and make a plant collection there. And this had never been done before. No botanist had ever done that trip. And it was a time when people just really weren't doing river trips. You couldn't just sign up to go down the river. They partnered up with a man named Norm Nevels, who had an idea of starting commercial river running expeditions in the Grand Canyon, which had never been tried before. And they built some boats, and they recruited some people to row them, and off they went down the river. No experience. Nobody in this trip had ever done whitewater river rafting before. Really didn't know what they were getting into. Elzada Clover was 41 years old at the time of this river trip, and she had been born on a farm in Nebraska. She could shoot a gun, she could ride a horse, you know, very like Indiana Jones kind of attitude towards the world, and she was obsessed with plants. At some point, she fell in love with cactus, and she decided she wanted to make a collection of all of the cactus in the Southwest. And so she went to the University of Michigan. She got her PhD in botany, which was pretty unusual for women at the time. Lois Jotter was one of her kind of students and mentees at the University of Michigan. She was 24 years old in 1938. She described herself as being bookish and a bit of a klutz. And she went into this with a certain amount of trepidation about what she was getting into. Clover decided to invite Jotter along so they could kind of chaperone one another on this trip. And Jotter had to spend a lot of time writing letters to her family to convince them that it was going to be okay. Lois packed all of her stuff up in boxes before she left, and she labeled the boxes, and she told her roommate what to do with them if she never came
back. This is like your letter.
Just like
my
letter.
You kind of did the same.
Yeah. Right? Right. I mean, yeah, I really channeled what she was feeling. You know, I felt that, right?
In their diaries, did you get a sense that they knew they were doing something quite unusual?
Yes. Yeah, I did. But they focused mostly on the botany and not on their gender. There was actually a pretty clear rejection that their gender was what was unusual about the trip. The journalists who covered the trip, and there were a lot of them, it was national front page headlines for quite a while, really focused on the fact that these were the first two non-Native women to make this journey. And Elzeta Clover in particular really hated that about the press. She wanted the focus to be on the fact that it was the first botany collection ever made at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. She tried to convince the journalists to cover it from that point of view, and that really never happened. Lois writes about getting her hands all cut up and bleeding while she's trying to put all of those stacks of plants and paper together between two pieces of wood. And you can imagine doing that with a cactus. Pretty tricky, finicky work, you know. Their journey was considerably longer than mine. They ran through three canyons on the Colorado River in Utah and Arizona, Cataract, Glen, and Grand Canyon. It took them 42 days to make that trip. There were six people in all and three boats, just like on my journey down the river. But their boats were wooden boats and had been sort of scrapped together by the person running the expedition. And Lois actually wrote that when they first put the boats in the water, she wasn't entirely sure they were going to float. So when they hit their first rapids, they hit it at very high water. It's monsoon season in the Southwest, which means it's raining, big thunderstorms. They lose a boat, it runs away from them, and they have to chase it. They capsize in one of the rapids. There's a couple of points where they end up widely separated from one another. And everything takes so much longer than they're expecting. They start running low on food. Really, especially the first half of the trip, they weren't prepared for what they were going to find.
If they were running low on food, I mean, what were they eating?
Everything was canned. So they had canned peaches and canned peas and canned butter. I don't know what
God.
That was like. They had Rye Krisp crackers, which were a brand of cracker that was actually marketed as a diet food at the
Hilarious.
Time. This is not what you want to be eating when you're doing hard work.
Not
outdoors.
Fuel, right? It's
no fuel. Yeah. So that's fun. They had Klim, which is a brand of powdered milk. Klim is milk backwards. And they would stir it into cups of river water. They would have to drink the water out of the river. Today, you do that as well, but you treat it. You've got all this fancy stuff you can add to the water that makes the dirt settle out and cleans it all up and makes sure, you know, it's safe to drink. And it's a whole process, right? But then they didn't have all of that stuff. There'd be all this mud on the bottom of the bucket, and they'd take the top water off, and they would stir in this powdered milk. And that was a pretty typical lunch for them. Powdered milk, crackers, maybe a can of fruit.
For contrast, what were you eating? Because I imagine you said you weren't sitting with a bucket of water waiting for the mud to settle, and you
No.
probably weren't eating canned peaches.
No, we had wonderful meals on my trip. I was really quite impressed. But I did almost none of the cooking on my trip. They were very kind, the boatmen who were rowing the boats on my expedition. And we had great meals. I mean, we had fresh eggs, you know, to make eggs in the morning, and steak dinners, and it was pretty nice.
That's fantastic.
And I was so hungry. I mean, you're out in the sun and the water all day, and you're doing work, and you're bushwhacking around in the thickets, and I would eat everything that was put in front of me, and I have no idea how Clover and Jotter did it.
Coming up, how their expedition impacted Elzeta and Lois's careers, and what Melissa's trip has meant for her.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Like you said, to them, the most important thing was the science, and it was the botany, the goal and intention of this trip. Did they achieve what they set out to do, and what was the sort of legacy they left behind?
They collected more than 400 species of plants. Those physical plant specimens are still in herbaria today all over the country, so they're still available for researchers to use today.
Do they deserve to be more famous? I mean, clearly you've been able to tell their story, but I mean, it feels like people should know them.
I think so, right? I mean, yeah, I think they have an incredible story. We wouldn't have any idea what the plant life in this region looked like before Glen Canyon Dam was built. Glen Canyon is a giant dam. Behind it is the second largest reservoir in the entire country. It's right at the head of the Grand Canyon. It changed everything about the ecology of this river. And nowadays, scientists spend a lot of time trying to figure out how that dam changed things and how we can manage it differently to protect the ecology of this incredibly iconic place, you know, the Grand Canyon.
What happened to them after? I mean, they both had a lot of life to live after this trip.
Elzeta Clover stayed at the University of Michigan for her entire career. She taught generations of students. She traveled all over the country and the world collecting cactus. Some of those still grow at the Botanical Gardens in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And eventually she retired to Texas, where she could be out west close to her cactus. She died well into her 80s, I believe it was. Lois Jotter kind of took her life in a different direction. Not long after the river trip, she got married. She had two children. She returned to the University of North Carolina to teach botany and environmental science and biology. And she got a chance to run the Grand Canyon one more time in 1994 at the age of 83.
Oh my God, I love this.
It's pretty cool. A group of scientists had gotten together and decided that they wanted to know what the river used to look like before that big dam was built at the head of the Grand Canyon. And so they invited Lois Jotter to come back on this trip because she could tell them what it used to look like half a century before.
The trip is a lot more recent for you. What impact has it had on you, and do you think it's going to be long-lasting?
I think doing it helped a great deal with my own self-confidence in situations like that. It sounds silly, but I think we all need that sometimes. Sometimes we need to prove to ourselves that we can do difficult and scary things that are outside of our comfort zone. I mean, being at the bottom of the Grand Canyon is a life-changing experience. Something about your perception changes. After about 3 days, you really forget what the outside world is like. You're completely cut off. There's no cell phone, there's no texting. You know, there's nothing but the river and the cliffs and the animals and the plants. And sleeping and rising with the sun and looking forward to the next rapid and the next meal. And you feel very human. I know that sounds strange, but it was like a revelation. It's like, this is what being a human is supposed to feel like. And it's so hard to come back to the outside world and to look around you at all of the strange markers we have of time. I was coming out in October around Halloween, and there were Halloween decorations, and there were pumpkin spice lattes in the stores. And these markers that we have of time make no sense. What makes sense is the sunrise and the sunset and the way the colors of the light change the canyon walls. I could have sat and watched that all day and never gone bored. So yeah, it did change my life in ways that I think I'll still discover as time goes on.
How often do you think about the Grand Canyon?
So I miss it, especially this time of year when the fall rolls around. I took my trip in October, and sometimes a scent or a smell or something will take me right back there. And yeah, there's kind of a longing. Both Clover and Jotter describe that coming out of the river, this instantaneous longing to go back And I don't know if I'm ever going to make it back. It's not necessarily easy or inexpensive to get on a river trip. So I don't know if I'll have that opportunity again, but I do think about it a lot.
Well, thank you so much for telling me all about it and taking me there. This was just such a fascinating and exciting conversation. I mean, I kind of felt like I was in a movie. Next week, the power and playfulness of an iconic cosmetic, eyeliner. Join us as Zara Hankir explores the intersections of beauty with health, spirituality, and freedom around the world, from the hair salons of Iran to the streets of Tokyo. See you then. I'm Lale Arakoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hannah. Our engineers are Jake Loomis and Gabe Kuroga. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Duke Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer. See you next week.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.